grasslands, if they're going to remain as grasslands, have to have some kind of disturbance. In terms of getting the most diverse group of birds on your grasses, the grazing is really kind of the key way to go.
Welcome to the 370th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. The first time I saw a direct connection between healthy grassland bird habitat and thriving livestock production was back in the mid-1990s, when I had the opportunity to write about the Monitoring Project, an LSP-led initiative involving a group of grazers who were farming in southeastern Minnesota. By working with wildlife biologists, soil scientists, economists, and other experts, the farmers were able to develop a set of practical indicators for gauging whether they were on the right track toward producing beef and milk in a manner that balanced ecological health with economic viability and a good quality of life. These farmers were pioneers in utilizing managed rotational grazing, a system that moves livestock through a series of paddocks in a carefully planned manner in such a way that it prevents overgrazing while spreading manure and urine on the land in a soil-friendly manner. By far, birds became the most popular sustainability indicator amongst monitoring team members. During pasture walks and other gatherings, farmers would excitedly share their sightings of bobolinks, meadowlarks, bluebirds, and other species that are extremely dependent on the presence of healthy, diverse, grass-based habitats. It turns out that there was a direct link between the presence of these avian critters and how much good forage was present in the farmers' grazing paddocks. And that meant there was a direct link between birds and beef, for example. More grassland birds equals more perennial forage, and that, in turn, translates into higher productivity for the animals being grazed on that farm. Over the years, I've had other opportunities to get a glimpse at how this blending of the wild and the domesticated can be a win-win for farmers and the environment. In northeastern Iowa, I witnessed a friendly competition between Dan and Phil Specht, farming brothers who vied to see whose grazing paddocks could attract the most bobolinks. In west central Minnesota, Loretta and Martin Jouse described to me how the number of bird species sighted on their dairy farm jumped from around a dozen to over 200 as they increased their focus on diversity, rotational grazing, and establishment of habitat. Traditionally, wildlife ecologists have had a negative view of the relationship between birds and working farmland. For good reason. Overgrazing, for example, can have a devastating impact on nesting success. However, there's no doubt that the work of the monitoring team, along with farmers like the Specks and Jouses, has played a major role in changing how wildlife ecologists view working farmland. As regenerative farmers receive more attention for blurring the boundaries between ecology and agriculture, members of the environmental community are coming to have a greater appreciation for the role rotational grazing of livestock can play in supporting healthy bird habitat. And getting such support is critical. After all, during the past 50 years, grassland birds have seen the steepest population declines of any other type of North American bird. The cause is pretty clear-cut. Prairies, pastures, and other grassland habitats have been methodically plowed up, paved, and otherwise pummeled into oblivion. Here in the Midwest, if we are to bring back any of that grassland habitat, we need to find a way to make growing perennial forages a viable and profitable way to farm. That's why I was thrilled to learn recently about what one environmental organization is doing to help farmers and ranchers get paid in the marketplace for undertaking what's called regenerative or conservation grazing. The National Audubon Society's Conservation Ranching Program certifies livestock producers who are utilizing managed grazing systems that are considered bird-friendly. In other words, they're rotating the animals in a way that they are contributing to a diverse mosaic of grasses and forbs. In April, I ran into Kristen Zumo, a grassland ecologist with Audubon out of its Upper Mississippi River office. She was one of the presenters at a Wild Farm Alliance field day being held at Keewaydin Farms in southwestern Wisconsin's Driftless region. I should say that the owners of Keewaydin, Joy Miller and Rufus Hockey, are doing some impressive things themselves to create and support grassland birds, and we'll feature their story on the next episode of Ear to the Ground. In the meantime, here's my conversation with Kristen. During our talk, she described the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program and why well-managed grazing has emerged as such an important tool for, as she puts it, bending the bird curve. So, Kristen, we just had a really, really a great field day here at Key Wayden Farm with Rufus and Joy, where they showed us some of the things that they've been doing to kind of blend the wild and the tame on their farm a little bit. And they talked really passionately about how they have become really enamored of bird habitat on their farm. And that was the focus of the field day. We did a nice walk through the farm and looked at some of the nest boxes they have, saw some bluebirds, saw some other grassland species. You had talked a little bit about a program that the Audubon Society has set up that's, I've heard about this before, but I think it's really interesting. And it sounds like it's something that has maybe been based more in the western part of the United States, but we're trying to maybe bring that here to the Midwest a little bit more. Can you talk a little bit about this program and what you're doing with it to a little bit, just describe what it is?
Yeah, so Audubon has, it's called the Conservation Ranching Program, and it started in Missouri in about 2016, 2017, and then went west.
Oh, okay.
So it's been very heavily focused out west, and in 2023, they hired on two ecologists, myself and one other here in Wisconsin, to bring it here to Minnesota, Wisconsin, and now we're even expanding into Iowa a bit. But the Conservation Ranching Program is Audubon's market-based approach to creating grassland bird habitat. We are working with grazing landowners. Right now, it's primarily beef and bison landowners to work with them and create bird habitat, grassland bird habitat, through grazing operations. Grassland birds are the steepest declining group of birds in North America. We've lost about 53% of them in the last 50 years, compared to some other groups that have lost maybe 20 to 25%. So 53% is a pretty steep decline. And so Audubon kind of got involved because they were looking at it from the perspective of, well, what do we do? How do we fix this? How do we, as Audubon likes to say, bend the bird curve and bring them back. In order to do that, most grasslands in North America are actually privately held or they are leased. So any of the federal lands are very often leased for private use for grazing operations. And so if we're going to do anything, if we're going to bend that bird curve, we had to kind of create a program that was going to work with those grazing landowners in order to do so.
So, describe the details of what exactly you guys are doing with this program. How did somebody signs up for it, and then what happens after that?
Yeah, so if somebody's interested in the program, it is a certification, so it's kind of similar to, it's a label that they would get on their product. That is the end outcome of it, of their beef and bison product. But what's different about it is that we're not certifying necessarily the beef or the meat product, where even though the label goes on it, we're actually certifying the habitat that beef and bison are being raised on. So we work with the landowners if they're interested in it, and my primary role is to create a habitat management plan that's going to incorporate their rotational grazing operation and some goals for the future that'll work towards creating better and more grassland bird habitat.
What are some of the things you're looking for? What is it you're trying to promote in there? You say rotation grazing, but it's more than that, right? What is it you're really trying to get them to be doing on some of these to get that certification?
Yeah, so for that, we're looking at how the rotations are being put into play. So how many animals they have, how often they're moving them, the size of the paddocks, and kind of what residual is being left behind. Residual is kind of a really big part of it, because in order for grassland birds to have enough habitat, there has to be enough vegetation for them there. Grassland birds are, everybody thinks, you know, if there's grass, then that grassland bird will probably be happy. But there's such a diverse amount of grassland birds species out there, everything from the horned larks and vesper sparrows that we have around here that really like more bare ground and very low vegetation, all the way to the things like eastern meadowlarks and bobolinks and henslow sparrows that want much more tall, dense kind of vegetation. And working with these grazing landowners, we're able to kind of look at their operation and see how we can rotate their cattle in the way that's going to create this mosaic of habitat for all of those species. So as they're moving their animals across the land, they can create some of this low habitat in the paddocks that maybe they're using right now, and maybe cut down a little bit lower with that grazing, maybe leave 4 to 6 inches or so of residual. Or they, in other paddocks, they can be leaving, you know, 8 to 10 inches of residual. But the most important thing that we're actually finding with grassland birds is that they they don't just want to have the grass there. There's a certain structure type that they want as well. And grazing animals like cattle and like bison, they create that structural diversity in that area as opposed to just like having, you know, a certain height of grass. They kind of pick here at some plants, they kind of pick there at some plants, and then they'll move along. And that kind of diversity in the structure is really what the birds are looking for. So that's what we're working with landowners to create.
So let's see if I can remember, if I can say this word and remember it correctly. Is this what I've heard people term heterogeneity? Heterogeneity. Heterogeneity. Yeah.
Heterogeneity.
Yes. Is that what that is?
Yeah, so we like using mosaic of habitats because it's easier to say.
Okay, I'm going to stick with that.
But yes, so basically the heterogeneity is creating a whole bunch of different types of structures within the same landscape. Mm-hmm. So it's making as many species happy as possible.
You called this a kind of a certification that can help them in the marketplace. How does that work? How are ranchers and farmers able to use that then to maybe get a higher price for raising livestock in a regenerative manner?
Yeah, so well, right now we don't have the data to show a higher price in the market, but we call it a market-based program because what we're looking at is trying to get consumers and using, in the last like decade or so, there's really been this high drive from consumers to really understand where their food is coming from a bit more. Mm-hmm. And so we're utilizing that drive to highlight that certain products are being created in a way that is really environmentally sound. And so the label that we're putting on there is basically saying this beef, this bison, whatever, this meat product was raised in a way that is supporting the environment and supporting grassland birds. And so the protocols that we have in the program that lead to certification have three different pillars kind of as a part of them. We have our habitat management plan, which is the plan that I write with each individual landowner. We have the animal health and welfare side of it. So we have certain standards that they have to meet to make sure that the animals are being taken care of. And then we have an environmental sustainability pillar as well, which goes into the, you know, lessening erosion, using less insecticides or herbicides, protecting the water quality and soils and stuff like that. So that's where it's coming from in terms of the encouraging the consumer to then look at that label and be like, I know this is protecting the land and I want to support that, so I'm going to buy this product. And that therefore then goes and encourages the landowner to continue doing that kind of work.
Do you have some numbers on how many producers you're working with and how many acres? Is there some rough idea of how much of a landscape impact we're having so far?
Yeah, so across the country, I think one of our most recent reports is about just under 3 million acres across the country so far. Because we've only been in the upper Midwest, so in Minnesota and Wisconsin for about 2 years, mm-hmm. I think we are probably totaling around 10,000 acres or so right now. There's a lot of landowners in the works. I know my counterpart here in Wisconsin, he's got like 35 people on the list waiting to go through the program. I've got a bunch of people over in Minnesota that are waiting to go through the program. So it's a pretty significant amount of interest we've had so far, which is fantastic, which is why we're trying to get more staff on board.
It takes boots on the ground.
Oh, it definitely takes boots on the ground. So we're hoping to get some more boots on the ground and try to work with some of the folks that are on our waiting list and waiting for us to come on out.
Going back a little bit to the certification and trying to get rewarded in the marketplace. So I guess I'm foreseeing a farmer or a rancher using this in terms of they have this certification. Let's say they're direct marketing or they're marketing to a certain place. They can then say, okay, we're certified as this, and that's an added thing that they can put on there. Mm-hmm. When they're doing their own marketing, rather than that there's a market out there that's there, you guys aren't doing the marketing for them or anything like that, right? This is them doing their own marketing and using this certification as an added incentive for folks to buy that.
Yeah, it is. It is for them to use how they see fit and will benefit them the most. But we also do have a really fantastic marketing team. So for folks that are going through the program, if they are direct marketers or if they go to a farmer's market, for instance, and have banners and stuff like that, we can provide that kind of stuff to them to highlight that. We've also worked with, our marketing team has worked with landowners in the past to help them improve their website and put a whole page on their website that details out the benefits of, you know, the way in which they're grazing and how it benefits the environment and birds. So we have a really fantastic marketing team that basically if a landowner has a desire to use that marketing, we will help them do whatever they're looking to do.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about the idea of the Audubon Society, one of the biggest environmental groups in the country, being involved with promoting grazing. And I think that might surprise some people. As you, I think, pointed out earlier, there has not been a, in the past, good history there between, say, livestock producers and environmental groups. So what's going on here? Why are we seeing this this kind of real active, very aggressive promotion of grazing and grass-based livestock production?
Well, yeah, if you look back at the history of, you know, how grasslands were managed historically, or not even managed, but how they remained as grasslands historically, you had basically two primary management options. You had bison, which were moving across and chewing down the grasses and keeping them as grasslands, or you had fire that came across the landscape. And we've kind of changed gears over, you know, the last century or so and restricted a lot of that stuff. But grasslands, if they're going to remain as grasslands, have to have some kind of disturbance, whether it be that grazing or that fire. And both of them have their place. They're both very useful. Prescribed fire is starting to get a lot more push, which is really fantastic. But when you do a prescribed burn across a landscape, you are taking off all of the grassland structure. So you're taking off all of the vegetation for a brief period of time. And that vegetation, as it grows back, kind of grows up at that same level. So it's maintaining that one structural level. But when you have grazing going across the landscape, when you have cattle going across the landscape, especially if you're rotating them in a way that creates that diversity, that, you know, low grass here, medium here, tall over here, the way in which cattle graze and they pick and choose different areas and things, it creates more of a structural diversity in that grassland. And that is a lot more appealing to a lot more diverse species of grassland birds than the single height kind of environment. That mosaic, yes, it's very, very important. And so you just can't get that any other way than grazing in the landscape. And when it's done well, and when it's done, you know, with the eye towards that intensive, that or that rotational kind of grazing, you're creating that structure. And so as we support the prescribed burns, we are active. A lot of our landowners use prescribed burns. But in terms of getting the most diverse group of birds on your grasses, the grazing is really kind of the key way to go.
But what strikes me about this is we're always looking for win-win situations. And not to overstate it, because that term is overused a lot. But in this case, I could see a farmer who has adapted rotational grazing and is seeing that it's increasing their productivity. They're able to get more livestock on fewer acres, and financially it's lower cost. Animals are healthier, that kind of thing. That maybe they start to see a connection between if that pasture that they're managing is got good grassland, good forage growth, a lot of good forbs, that kind of thing, good diversity, and it's good for their livestock, they're also then noting certain birds, and they're connecting birds as an indicator of, oh, what's good for the birds is good for my livestock. Am I going too far on that? I mean, is that a good connection there?
That is a good connection, and it's one of the things that we often tell people is that birds are fantastic indicators of whether or not a landscape is healthy. Birds aren't going to show up at the local or the larger landscape level if what they need is not there. And what they need is the vegetation that has those great roots that holds the soil in place and holds the water in place. And that vegetation also provides a lot of insects, which is something that they need very heavily for nesting. Pretty much the only thing they're feeding their nestlings in the first couple of weeks is insects. And you're not going to have insects if you don't have that healthier vegetation. And so they really are that indicator species or that indicator group, and it's very easy to spot them on the landscape, not just visually, but we hear them everywhere. Yeah. Everybody I know knows the sound of meadowlarks on the landscape, and if you've got meadowlarks, you've got some really good grass.
A few years ago, I interviewed some farmers in northeast Iowa who were using bobolinks as an indicator because it's such a obligate species. It has to have good grass habitat. Yeah. It can't survive in trees or whatever. So when they were realizing for their beef and dairy operations that when we see bobolinks, that means we're doing something right with the grassland management here.
Yeah, and honestly, I use bobolinks and some kind of anecdotal stories for myself for bobolinks quite often because I've worked with a lot of conservation organizations, some of which have really spent a lot of time managing these tracts of grasslands to try to get grassland bird species, specifically bobolinks, back on the property. But their primary way to manage the land has been prescribed fire or, you know, cutting down the shrubs that are kind of encroaching in and things like that. They don't use grazing and they don't have any bobolinks. So anecdotally for me, I'm always saying if you don't graze your landscape, you're going to probably eventually lose the bobolinks. And I have no, you know, scientific data and research to back it, but from what I've seen, a lot of the places that have bobolinks are the ones that are grazing.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck me that you said during the bird walk and during the presentations here today was the attraction for the Audubon Society is, yes, it's good for habitat and good for the birds that we're trying to protect and promote and all of that. But that this particular practice, this particular management system is also good for farmers. That you were able to make that connection there.
Oh, yeah. It's really, really good for farmers. Rotational grazing is just, there's so many benefits. And I've worked with a lot of landowners that they've been able to increase the number of cattle they have on their land because of the rotational grazing. Because as you're moving cattle through a landscape in these different paddocks, they're constantly getting fresh nutrition, fresh grass each time they're moved. And when they do that, that grass behind them then gets a lot of rest period. A lot of them have 30 to 60 days of rest before the cattle come back to that. And it allows that grass to really grow and get all like those fresh nutrients back. But the cattle, because they're constantly getting fresh nutrition, they're putting on a lot more weight. And there are certain landowners that have been able to add more cattle to their operation because of that rotation, which a lot of people think that they must have to cut back on the amount of cattle that they have because now they have to put them in smaller areas. Yeah. It's just not necessarily the case. They also don't have to have as many, they have much cheaper vet bills. I have some folks who they're just like, the only time I see the vet is when they have to give like tag them after birth, or you know, if we're going through, you know, the artificial insemination process, and they're for the rest of the year we don't see the vet. And then the other inputs in terms of like fertilizer and pesticides and insecticides and stuff, they don't have to put all of that out there. And then the rotations themselves, there's often a kind of like this myth that it takes a lot more time to do rotational cattle. But in order to move them once a day, it takes maybe 15 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot less time than having to go out and plant a ton of fields and spray a bunch of times and spread manure a bunch of times. The cattle are doing that themselves. They're spreading the manure as they're walking around. So it saves the landowner a lot of money, and it puts a lot of nutrients back into their soils, and it takes care of their land, and it protects their land from erosion. And there's a lot of benefits.
And it gives them an incentive to keep that land covered in perennial cover.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
They don't. They're like, okay, maybe plowing up to corn and beans doesn't have to be the only financial option that I have out there.
Yeah, there's a lot more options out there. And I think as I've been doing a lot of these events and going to a lot of pasture walks and such, and there's a lot of desire out there to learn more and to try some new things. And I think that's really great.
Besides the ecological benefits and the financial benefits for the farmer, are you, with working with some of these producers, are you seeing, I guess maybe a, for want of a better term, a peace of mind or a psychological benefit where these farmers maybe learn more about what's on their land and what kind of habitat it can provide, and you know, they hear the birds and see the birds and go, oh, I don't know, it makes maybe farming a little funner for them?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of the landowners that I work with, and as we're going through this certification process and certifying some of the first farms in the area, we do interviews and such with them, preparing for some press releases and such, and the things that I hear the most from a lot of them is just how much they're enjoying hearing everything and taking care of that land. Mm-hmm. And it's just the most important thing to them because, I'd have to get the quote right, but there's a quote from Aldo Leopold, of course, but it's talking about how the landscape of the farmer is really the portrait of themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's just what they see, is that reflection of their land is a reflection of them, and they want to care for it as much as they can. And I've never met a farmer who didn't want to take care of and love their land, and that's all they're trying to do.
As I mentioned earlier, the next Ear to the Ground episode will describe what Keewaydin Farms is doing to integrate bird habitat into their vegetable and livestock operation. For information related to blending wildlife and working farmland, including a link to Audubon's conservation ranching program, See the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 370 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.